Okay, I really thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate to be in this celebration, and I owe a lot to the influence of Catherine in a lot of things on linear PD and also non-linear, and in fact on propagation of energy, so which I learned from her paper. So what I want to do, I want to do a series of very simple remarks on this extremely classical problem, which is the Navier-Stokes and Euler equation. And I want really to focus on issue concerning energy and energy decay. And what goes with this issue of energy is the fact that in some sense, and I want to argue on that, if you want to know, make progress on Navier-Stokes, you have really to focus on the incompressible Euler equation, and you have also practical reason to focus on the Euler equation, which I wrote here, which are well known. Okay, so in some sense, first I want to give examples which are simple but pathological. Some of them are well known. Then I want to discuss some issue about conservation of energy and weak limit, and at the end I will try to make a connection between the theory of Kolmogorov and Wigner measure. That's what I try to do. But all these topics, they are really linked. So first, there is a series of things which are monsters, which are like Navier-Stokes, but just do not satisfy the conservation of energy. So what you learn from that? First example is extremely simple, is instead of you relax the pressure, you write the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and you know everything for this one because it's extremely simple. When you take the gradient, it's an n-dimensional Hamilton-Jacobi equation. You know that with a positive viscosity, it is smooth for all time because you have maximum principle, and for zero viscosity, it blows up. So it's okay, everything is known, but you have no conservation of energy. A more sophisticated example of the same type is the one which was proposed by Montgomery Smith. This is an equation which has all the scaling of Navier-Stokes, but it doesn't preserve the energy. Now, if you are in a bounded domain, you just introduce the first eigenvector of the Dirichlet problem, phi 1 is solution of minus Laplacian of phi 1 equal lambda 1 of phi 1, and you know it's a positive function. Then you multiply the equation by phi 1, you turn the crank, and you prove that for initial data which is large enough, which have a moment which is large enough, you have a blow up in a finite time. And I really want to stress that this one has exactly all the scaling of, let's say, which were used in Cohn, Caffarelli, and Ehrenberg, and it doesn't have the conservation of energy, and it violates the result because you have singularity which are much of a bigger set than what was proven in this paper. Now, move on. In this family, you can make some extension. You find out that you can extend this problem to the whole space, and you prove the same proof of Montgomery Smith, prove that singularity may appear in the whole space. I want to mention that you don't have, you know that you don't have the positivity of the sign for the first eigenvector, so if you look at problem in with boundary, it's still a completely open problem. So just to say that. So, that's the first example. The second example, now, okay, so now I write for, because I need to write it at least once, the Navier-Stokes and Euler, for they are the incompressible one, and the thing I keep in mind is this relation, which is the relation of energy. Okay? It should be unequal if everything would be smooth, we know that, but the Lorentz solution satisfies is just inequality. And when nu is equal to zero, you just have the conservation of energy. And, of course, when u is equal to zero, this goes away, and you can write the Euler equation as a zero-order non-linear. You can introduce zero-order non-linear absolute differential operator, And your first idea is that the Euler equation will behave like y prime less than c y at the power 3/2 for the norm of, there will be for the norm of u in HS when h is, when s is greater than n over 2 plus 1. This is something which is well known. What you keep in mind is that in this space, which is very good, you have local well-posedness. That goes back to Liechtenstein, I think, with Euler experiment. Now, what happens if you deviate from that? There is a very simple classical example. I think it's much older than Peter Constantine, but it was written in our language by Peter, I will say, and he really wrote the thing well. You look at special solution of the Euler equation, which are first component depend on x1 and x2, second depend also on x1 and x2, and the third one is x3 gamma of x1 and x2, which is linear in x3. And you look at this type of solution in a domain that will have this shape, which will be periodic in x1 and x2, and extend all the way up to x3. So, if it extends all the way, you are very far from conservation of energy. But you can start with very smooth initial data. You produce a very simple Riccati equation, and you show that it's well posed for finite time in some norm, local norm, but then it blows up in a finite time. And it is almost explicit. So that, once again, okay. So having said that, now I try to focus on guys that do satisfy the energy estimate. So there's a very simple example, and I think it's quoted in the book of Lyons, Pierre-Louis Lyons, as an example written by him and Randy Perna. But you can learn a lot of things from this example. You look at solution that will be of the form U1, which depends on the second component. The second component is zero, and the third component is of the form U3 of X1 minus T time of U1 of X2 and X2. And you find that this type of solution are exact solution of the incompressible Euler equation. They are exact solution. They are solution in 2 1/2 dimension, some of the spirit of what Walter just did before. And then you turn the crank. You can compute just the derivative of this guy. And you observe that the derivative of U3 is just the derivative with respect to the first argument of U3. There's this first term and there's this second term. Now, the second term, there is a T in front of it, which means that there's a big difference for the case where T equals zero and the case where T is not equal to zero, which means you can construct solution which jumps immediately from being of norm in W1P equal 1 to immediately just after that for any P between 1 and infinity, at any positive time, they will not be in LP. So that the message is that the solution is unstable, at least in W1P. Well, W1P is not very close to HS for S greater than 3, than N over 2 plus 1. There is a gap. Try to see what goes on in the gap. Okay? Now, so to focus on what goes on in the gap, one can move one step further. One step further will be to try to see if we do have weak solution. And what is well known is that in two space dimension, there are weak solutions because you have the conservation of vorticity. And what is also well known is that we don't know how to construct weak solution in more than two space dimension. Nevertheless, with this example, in 2D and in 3D, there are a lot of pathological things to notice. The first thing, okay, so you have a weak solution. You have a weak solution very easily when the vorticity at time zero is in LP for P between 1 and infinity. And the case P equal 1 can be handled when the vorticity as is a measure, up to the case of diversity, a measure with a distinguished sign, or with change of sign which are reasonably simple. So, okay, you have solution in 2D. Now what about uniqueness? The uniqueness turns out to be not so easy, and I think the result goes back to Volibner, before the, in the 30s, where he really analyzed the pair dispersion, which is the distance between two trajectories. And since you are in the case where you are the limit of the Sobolev theorem, you have a log Sobolev estimate. That's the modern way, which already is due to Yudovich, of looking at the work of Volibner. With that, you have uniqueness if the vorticity is in L infinity. Now, there is a big gap between vorticity being a measure and vorticity being in L infinity. And the question is what one can say for weak solution. And the answer is quite recent. And the answer is that the situation is pretty bad. And it's as bad in two space variable as in three space variable. And the answer is given by two papers of Delelis and Seske Dili, and their result, and I flash their result because it's very instructive. They started by proving, they started from paper of Schnirelmann and Schaeffer, where this guy constructed solution of the 2D Euler equation that were in L2 in X time with compact support both in space and time. And they constructed by accumulating oscillation near the point where they reach zero. Now, Delelis and Seske Dili had the idea of doing the same thing, but in a much more formal way, using the argument of Tartar and then the Baer theorem. And with that, they used the Baer theorem. They have had a large infinity of pathological case. And for instance, they get this result that they can have an infinite class of initial data for which you would have in 2D and in 3D solution that will not satisfy uniqueness, but that will satisfy the criteria. And the criteria is exactly the entropy criteria, because for the earlier, the analogous of the entropy will be the energy. That's a criteria I learned from the Fermat, that in principle, if things goes well, when you have an entropy inequality, you have stability. So the answer is, for the Euler equation, there are initial data for which these criteria do not ensure uniqueness. And in fact, it's still a decay of energy. Okay, so let's go on for this question of decay of energy. I skip that. Now, another idea one can borrow from the people that did conservation law is also an idea of the Fermat, which is to compare smooth solution with weak solution. So that would be the stability between between the smooth solution and the weak solution. And if you interpret that in the sense of the incompressible equation, you get a notion which was introduced by Pierre-Louis Lyons, which is the notion of dissipative solution. What you do, you write your earlier equation like that, and you write an equation for a test function. So the earlier equation, you don't know if it's smooth or not. Let's say it's in the situation of Delelis and Seske Dili. It's weakly continuous from ZOT in L2. But nevertheless, it satisfies this equation in the sense of distribution. Then you take a function which is smooth, which is divergence-free, and when you have boundary conditions for the Euler equation, the boundary condition, the flow doesn't penetrate the boundary, the normal derivative has to be zero on the boundary. So you take functions like that, they are divergence-free, they don't satisfy the Euler equation, so there is a reminder here. So you write the two equation, you turn the crank, you integrate by parts, and you get an inequality that will satisfy any solution of the Euler equation compared to a smooth function. And you will say that the Euler equation, this is a dissipative solution, If the search inequality is satisfied, the L2 norm between U and W is bounded by something that would be that will involve the divergence, or let's say the tensor dW, and multiply U of 0 minus W of 0, and then also the remainder term on the right, which is E of W. So keep this formula in mind. I will use it on the next slide to observe first that if U is a classical solution, then you can, the first thing you observe that if U is a classical solution, then it is a dissipative. You just have this expression. The second thing you observe, you take W equals zero, and you obtain a series of good property, which is the first one, that if W is equal to zero, then you ensure that the energy decays. So you have already excluded some of the pathological example of Delelis. Then you can also show that any solution that will satisfy a weak energy inequality, which is that the integral of V of x and t square minus V of x and s square, this inequality would hold whenever, let's say, s is less than t, then this is a dissipative solution. The last thing is really the inequality in the sense of the Fermos. Assume that W is a classical solution, then you have an estimate on the stability of U of t with respect to W of t in terms of the initial data. And in particular, you pick up the idea that if you have a classical solution and a dissipative solution, if they have the same initial data, then they will coincide. Okay? So, now, I'm trying to think what is the room left for weak solution, where they could stay. Weak solution that will not be classical solution. So, weak solution with not conservation of energy, but with weak energy inequality, they may exist and differ from a classical solution only if you don't have a classical solution, which means either you have a loss of regularity after a finite time, because the persistence of the regularity of the Euler equation in 3D is an open problem, or if you have a loss of regularity, or if you take wild initial data, like in the example of Delelis. That the only room which is left for having something that will be a weak solution and not a smooth solution. Okay, very good. I didn't say much about boundaries. And another observation that one makes immediately is that if you have no boundary, you look at the energy, and you can show very easily that any dissipative solution will be any limit of a viscous Navier-Stokes equation with no boundary will be a dissipative solution, which means that if you have a smooth solution of Euler and no boundary, then this quantity will go to, which is the energy dissipation, will go to zero with viscosity. And that due to the fact that you have no boundaries. Now, I want to point out that if you have boundary, the situation becomes much more complicated. It's known that the Clay problem addresses to the existence of non-existence of smoothness of Navier-Stokes in 3D. I just would like to mention that I think that the problem in 2D, you know that the Euler equation has a smooth solution for all time, if you take smooth initial data. You know also that the Navier-Stokes has a smooth solution for all time. In the meantime, you take U equals zero on the boundary, you let the viscosity go to zero, then almost nothing serious is known about what will happen to the solution when the viscosity goes to zero. Okay? And I want to mention that. And in fact, there is a theorem of Kato, which I mentioned that here, which is, I want to go on, which is quite the only sharp result I know, which really, you assume you have a smooth solution for a less, they say in 2D, 3D would be the same. Then, basically, the fact that Navier-Stokes converges to Euler is completely equivalent to the fact that the dissipation of energy near the boundary will converge to zero. And if you don't have that, this dissipation of energy, you won't have conservation of, you won't have, the limit won't be Navier-Stokes. Okay, so, try to move on with this idea of energy, and I want to say more about dissipation of energy. So I'm trying to convince you that the real important thing is this inequality, you know, and that in the boundary value problem, this quantity should go to zero. And I already said, using this dissipative solution, that in the absence of boundary and with a smooth solution of the Euler equation, one has this limit, which is always equal to zero. Now, one wonders whether this limit of this quantity, will be an epsilon, which will be strictly positive. And inequality would appear either if the limit will be a weak solution with wild initial data, or some loss of regularity if you are without boundary. So that means people have been really focused on what will be the threshold of irregularity of the initial data that will be compatible with decaying of energy. Well, I mentioned that because it's a natural way to make a connection between this issue of energy and the statistical theory of turbulence. So what statistical turbulence would say? The idea is to look at solution where you have an average flow, which is smooth, with mean value, and you have a fluctuation of mean value zero. And it's, you assume that U tilde is a random variable. Now, random variable is never specified in physics. It's random with respect to something. But basically, there's an hypothesis which is called the Taylor hypothesis, which says that if you take average with respect to anything, time, space, number of experiments, you will get the same solution. In some sense, people in turbulence assume a kind of super Birkhoff theorem to work with. When they do that, they look at the average of U tilde of X, the average of the correlation, binary correlation between the velocity at one point and the velocity at another point, and they try to get results. And the standard result of Kolmogorov goes as follow. If you assume isotropy of this with respect to R, which basically means invariant under Galilean transformation and homogeneity, and you assume that it behaves like a power law, then in the average you will get that this correlation is this difference is in the average like R at the power 1/3, and that this number is a finite non-zero number. Okay, so that would mean that this thing, which is here, says that in the average, what will be the average means? The solution in the Euler space, C13, which means that you should expect that this number will be a discriminant for the fact that you have decay of energy or non-decay of energy. And this is an introduction to the talk, I think, that Suzanne will give later on, she gives criteria for having conservation of energy. Okay, so that's where I am. Next, I try to give you a formalization of this issue of energy and conservation in what will be my language. And the idea is first to move to Fourier transform. That was done by the people by the time of Kolmogorov on Sager. And basically, you can try, instead of looking at that in space, you can take a Fourier transform, and the same scaling analysis will give a property for the spectra, which they call the Kolmogorov spectra. And these things are very used. They are used to validate numerical code in turbulent regime, and they are used to simulate the contribution of the small scale. Now, in the how many minutes I have?
10.
Okay, so I don't need to rush. Then what I meant is my point. I want to, at this point, to make the connection between this presentation, which was done by Kolmogorov, which is due to Kolmogorov on Sager and these people, and an approach just in our language in terms of weak convergence. And there is a natural tool that does that for you that you would have recognized here, which is called the Wigner transform and the Wigner measure. And that's what I want to do. So you say, if you keep in mind that in this business of statistical theory, you have a region where you have the scaling, which is called an inertial range, and with this invariant vorticity, you have this form, which is a consequence of the Galilean invariance. Okay, so now I move to this issue, and I still have the same inequalities at the beginning. It's really the only thing I know on this type of equation. Okay, now I consider a situation where U will converge weakly to its limit, U bar. I assume that U bar is smooth, but I don't know anything about the strong convergence. So for all the people here in this audience, they know that the big issue is the difference between the limit of the average and the average of the limit. And you measure that by a tensor, which I will call RT of U nu, which will be the limit of U nu minus U bar, tensor U nu minus U bar. This is a positive definite tensor, and whenever it's zero, it's equivalent to get the strong convergence. Otherwise, it's not. Okay. Now, what I want to do, the first thing, I look at this quantity. First, I want to look at the physical hypothesis. Assume that I have isotropy in the sense of the people of statistical theory of turbulence, which means it's invariant with respect to Galilean transform. Then it's a symbol of algebra that if U bar is not zero, you can express this tensor as the alpha time, the identity, plus a coefficient you don't know, but there is a coefficient that multiply the matrix delta of U bar plus its adjoint. And then you plot that in the equation, and you find out that if beta has the right sign, by the way, it will be positive here, then you have a well-posed problem, something which is stable. And I will call this beta the turbulent viscosity, and beta equals constant is classical engineering. It corresponds to the Smigorinsky model. You can have other equations to compute beta leading to K epsilon. Now, I want to say that this hypothesis of isotropy is not always true. If I go back to my first example, one of the first examples, make it oscillate, I see it doesn't satisfy this hypothesis. But other kinds, but you can assume that it's often true. Okay. Now, I move on one step further, and I look at this, instead of an average, I will look at a weak limit. And to do that, I localize, because I want to deal also with problem with boundary, so I localize in space. I just assume this relation, that u times the integral of omega of 0 infinity to the integral of omega of gradient of nu squared dx is less than a constant, which by definition I will call that nu oscillating. And then I take the Wigner transform of the correlation at the scale square root nu over 2. And then I go back to the existing theory. The existing theory says that when the v nu are bounded, square root of nu oscillating, then this quantity, which is the Wigner transform, will converge to an object which is a Wigner measure. It recovers the positivity at the limit. It's a positive tensor. It's a Wigner measured tensor. And it measures exactly the defect of convergence, which means at the limit, the equation satisfies what will be the classical Euler equation plus a turbulent term that you can write in term of Wigner, that you can describe with the Wigner measure. So that will say that for me turbulence will be when this quantity is not zero. Now, this is just a dictionary, a translation from statistical theory to weak turbulence, but it gives a lot of things, or something, and that's the thing I want to finish with. I want science, it's a weak limit, it involves only high frequency. You can look at this property in terms of pseudo-differential operator. And if you take a very simple zero-order pseudo-differential operator, phi of x, psi of k, inject that against this measure, integrate, you observe that it is the limit of the localized function phi of u nu multiplied by Fourier transform psi rescale like the square root of nu k moved away. That's just simple pseudo-differential calculus with the use of the energy estimate. But that gives different things. That gives first the fact that this tensor is a local object at variance with Kolmogorov theory, which really needed the thing to be defined everywhere. It's a locally dependent just on x and t. It's a criteria for turbulence, because when it's zero, then there is a strong convergence and you have no turbulence. Okay? And if I want to do the last slide, furthermore, you can observe, still with this nice formula which is here, that it depends only on the sequence of viscous solutions, the union between a fixed number and a number of the order b over the square root of nu. So it gives a proof that the thing depends only on the Fourier transform in a certain scale, which is, in fact, a proof of the necessity or the pertinence of what people in turbulence call the inertial range. And the last thing, you can try to see how look at the transfer of energy. You apply the same formula, and you observe that if you localize in frequency d over dt of RTK, you will get a formula that will involve locally the quantity nu, the square root of phi of k, which is dissipation of energy, and an object that you will see in the, I think, in the lecture of Suzanne, which is called the energy transfer, and you see that it contributes explicitly to the limit and to the property of this tensor. Okay, that's what one can say, and that's what I repeat here. That will be, this object really is what appears in construction of people that were done by T.T., Konstantin, and now Suzanne, to really evaluate the global conservation or non-conservation of energy. Well, that's in a sense, is just just use as much as I can. I just did use as much as I can this formula, which is really embedded in the structure, almost in the definition of the linear transform with the energy estimate, and that gives all what I wanted to show, which is not much, but it's a translation of the use of this formula. Okay, so that's it.